when I saw Crowley first. I was 7 years old. I used to, whoever I was walking alongside, say my sisters or my father and mother, I used to creep to the other side to get at the back of them so that I wouldn't be seen. It was this figure of him, you know, how he was dressed up. Very frightening. He had a great big long black cloak. We called it a cloak. It covered him all up, right down to his ankles. And then he had this great big broad hat. And it came to a peak at the top. And that itself looked a bit weird. Because there was nobody about that wore the same clothes. We creeped in to the side of the road when we saw him. We saw him coming at a distance. So we said to one another, "There's Crowley." So when we came up to him, he said, "No," he said, "don't be frightened of me. I won't harm you." But we passed him like that so often on the road that I got used to him. And then I didn't mind. Not one bit, no. I would go up to the house at Boleskine with a message or anything, and I didn't mind. Even the postman left the mails at the foot of the drive. I was the caretaker at the lodge. They wouldn't go up near the place.
Ellen Williamson, now 88 years old, remembers well the imposing and sinister figure of Alistair Crowley sweeping through the Inverness village of Foyers in the early years of this century. The man who delighted in the title The Beast believed he was the new Messiah and was later vilified in the press as the man they'd like to hang, clearly terrified the villagers. But why should the son of a wealthy Warwickshire brewer choose this Highland setting to further his career as a black magician? Writer Colin Wilson, acknowledged as one of Britain's foremost authorities on the occult, has just published a biography of Crowley.
To some extent, it was an accident. What he needed to begin with was a house where he could carry out a long magical ritual, which actually takes 6 months to perform. And he needed a place with a door opening to the north, and there had to be a terrace he could cover with fine sand, and a kind of a lodge where he can make the spirits congregate. And he just searched and searched throughout 1899, and then finally found what he wanted at the southern shore of Loch Ness, near Foyers, this Boleskine house. The owner rented it to him very cheaply. Incidentally, Crowley always tried to give the impression that he was the owner of the place, and of course gave himself the title the Laird of Boleskine.
Crowley reveled in the idea of being a Highland laird, even though his so-called estate was only 2 acres. According to Highland-based writer and historian Elizabeth Sutherland, that was typical of the Crowley character.
I think he had delusions of grandeur. He believed that he was from Celtic stock and that he was a descendant of Louise de Kerouac, who was the mistress of Charles II, I believe, wasn't she, the Countess of Portsmouth. And so when he came up to the Highlands, he felt that having taken on a big house, he should act the part of the laird. So he called himself the Laird of Boleskine and Abertawe. And he had this notepaper with a coronet at the top of it and 4 coats of arms, all from the best families in the land. And I think there was also an Egyptian inscription on it as well.
It wasn't only his appearance that marked Crowley out as someone to be feared in and around the sleepy village of Foyers. Willie Batchin, who's lived in the area all his life, recalls stories told by his uncle, a gardener at Boleskine House during Crowley's time there.
Just below Boleskine House is a burial ground, the old burial ground. And during the funerals there, Alistair Crowley, or Lord Boleskine as he called himself, would come out and with a shotgun and volley shots over the heads of the mourner. Within the house, he had a room which had all mirror. And when he got the people into the rooms, he would shut the door, and there was no way they could get out. I think he drove fear into many of the servants that way. And also, within that room of mirrors, he had a skeleton made up there. So once they got in, they couldn't get out unless he opened the door. I think there was some people that saw inside that room of mirrors when he wasn't there.
When you went in the door, you saw yourself there, right round the room. That itself was a bit frightening to anybody. He had this wee table, small little table. He sat on the floor, and he had this table in front of him with his food. And it's there that he had his meals. In that room, there was no chairs or anything like that in the room. Just a bare big rug. And it was a bare skin rug. Beautiful.
Ellen Williamson, whose mother used to help out as a cleaner in the house and who, as a little girl, had the run of Burlesque, even that mirrored room, when the master was away from home, of course. Crowley chose Burlesque for the lengthy Abramelin ritual of conjuring up his guardian spirit. Sween MacDonald, known as the Highland Seer, is widely credited with having his own psychic abilities, those of second sight. He's a fervent believer in the paranormal and says the choice of Burlesque wasn't purely accidental.
He was searching for a particular place where there'd be power. Now, he also searched the north of England, Yorkshire, the Lake District. He searched the whole of Scotland from the north to the south until he found Burlesque, which was a push hill at that time. Burlesque is built on one of the old ley lines where there's a power. There was a power there. When Crowley went to Burlesque, this was when a lot of the power started within him, where he could write, where he could call up demons, where he could do things, where he cursed people that upset him. Burlesque helped him, and he helped Burlesque. He was a very evil man. The things that he did, no other human person could have done. To animals and to people.
But Crowley was also a brilliant man, an expert chess player, adventurous mountaineer, talented writer and poet, accomplished linguist. But as a magician, he may have overestimated his powers to control his creations.
Unfortunately, instead of the guardian angel, he raised what he described as a host of demons, which shows perhaps that he either misunderstood the ritual that he was performing, or perhaps his own nature, his own character intervened. I suppose the modern psychologist would say that he raised them in his head. Whether he raised actual forces or creatures that other people could see as well, I would find very difficult to answer. But in view of the fact that I most certainly do believe in psychic phenomena in the paranormal, I would have to say I suppose that he did.
When I started writing about the occult, I assumed that magic was a lot of nonsense. In fact, John Simmons says so in his book, The Great Beast. He says, you know, there's only one trouble with magic, it doesn't work. Now, the more I studied this, the more I realized this is just not true. It does work. And it works. You know, I'm almost ashamed to say this. It sounds so nutty. But it works because spirits exist, and so-called magicians actually make use of spirits. I didn't believe that for years and years, but I finally come to believe it. Now, Crowley knew this from the beginning, and that's what his magic was all about. You know, in other words, it's really what happens at spiritualist seances, in a way. You're getting in touch with some rather nasty entities, the juvenile delinquents of the spirit world, and getting them to do things for you, which is, you know, not very good either for you or for them.
Burlesque House itself may know the secret of what Crowley was able to conjure up, and if indeed some evil spirit influenced the subsequent catalogue of death, despair and insanity which plagued those connected with Crowley and the house itself. The current owner is rock guitarist Jimmy Page, formerly of Led Zeppelin, who, since the hippie cult of the 60s embraced Crowley and his theories, has been a scholar, though not a follower of Crowleyanity, as the previous Laird of Burlesque christened his own religion. Page doesn't live in the house, but has a vague plan at some future date to house his extensive collection of Crowley books and memorabilia, a museum rather than a shrine to the beast. Meanwhile, one of the rock star's oldest friends, Malcolm Dent, lives there with his family, and he's been responsible for much of the extensive restoration work on Boleskine House carried out since the early 70s. And according to Malcolm Dent, there was a spiritual presence in the house even before Crowley's time.
The only traditional ghost associated with Boleskine, Crowley himself wrote about, Simon Lord Lovett, the gentleman who was beheaded after the Jacobite Rebellion, whose head apparently inhabits the house. His head was chopped off for treason, and his head appears to roll about the house. Although, as I say, appears, one doesn't see it, one hears it. And I must also add, not for quite some years has anyone noticed it. Maybe we don't even notice it anymore, I don't know. Crowley was very amused by this ghost, because at first it used to roll around up and down the corridor, and he shifted a billiard table, I believe, into this room we're in at the minute, which is now our living room, and he said it confined its activities to the top of the billiard table thereafter. He was quite amused by it, I think.
And no doubt he'd be quite amused by other goings-on in the house 40 years since his death. Malcolm Dent says the family's become accustomed to unexplained noises and other phenomena, particularly when parts of the house are undergoing renovation.
We've got a set of 7 chairs, which I believe the history of them is that they were originally in the Café Royal in London, which Crowley, amongst other people, frequented. There are, I can't remember all the names. Crowley, they have a large blue plaque in the back with the name of a famous bod and what they did for a living, or what they pretended to do for a living. For example, Murray Lloyd's chair is there. Sir Billy Butlin's chair is in the collection. James Agate, who was a critic and journalist. And Crowley, and Rudolph Valentino had a chair as well. And some years ago, we decided that these chairs could do with cleaning up and restoring, and the brakes and the rest of it repaired. So the chap that did them, without thinking about it, and I hadn't thought to tell him, he simply removed all these blue wooden plaques from the back of them, took care of them so that the lettering on them was not damaged, stacked them up somewhere, did all the job to them, put all the plaques back in, not necessarily in the chairs from which they'd originally come, and duly gave them back to us. Very nice, too. They were very nice. They looked very nice. And so we put them around the dining table. And for some weeks thereafter, Murray Lloyd's chair and Alistair Crowley's chair kept changing places overnight. You'd come in after a day or two or whatever, you hadn't been in there, and they'd have moved and changed places, and the rug always used to be shuckled up right across the room. Again, we didn't know why. So I religiously put them back where they belonged. I knew where they belonged because I always kept Crowley's chair at the head of the table and the other 6 down each side. And I think for about 3 months, every so often, these two would be shifted, none of us having had anything to do with it. And then it stopped.
Spine-chilling stuff. Whether you believe in ghosts or spirits or not, whether you believe it is possible for the evil Crowley believed he could master to exert an influence on people, objects, and events years later, it is difficult to dismiss experiences such as these entirely. Certainly Colin Wilson is convinced of Crowley's magical abilities.
He often demonstrated his magical powers, usually in a rather unpleasant sort of way. And for example, one man went down on all fours and proceeded to bark like a dog and scratch at the door. On another occasion, he was walking down Broadway with a friend who said, "Demonstrate your magical powers." So he said, "Okay." And he fell into exact step behind a stockbroker who was walking along swinging his briefcase. And then quite suddenly, Crowley let his knees buckle and fell to the pavement for just a brief moment and sprang up again. At the same time, the stockbroker in front of him also buckled, fell onto the pavement, and looked around in a bewildered way for the banana skin. So there's no doubt whatever that Crowley did have very peculiar powers. Also, of course, great hypnotic powers where women were concerned. I mean, it may just partly have been his attractiveness, but there are so many dozens of stories, for example, of Crowley standing looking in a shop window in the Strand,
A very attractive woman stood at the side of him, and then suddenly her eyes met Crowley's in the reflection in the glass, and they disappeared into the Savoy together and spent 10 days together, at the end of which she got a divorce from her husband. Oh, this kind of thing happened again and again.
And as Elizabeth Sutherland explains, his first marriage followed this pattern entirely.
His great friend, Gerald Kelly, Sir Gerald Kelly the painter, was staying at Boleskine with him. And at the same time, Gerald Kelly's mother and sister Rose were staying in Strathpeffer. Now, Sister Rose had got into great trouble with two young men, both of whom wanted to marry her. Gerald Kelly went over to see her, taking the Laird of Boleskine with him. And the Laird of Boleskine must have looked rather grand, in full Highland regalia, sporting the MacGregor tartan. Anyhow, he had a solution to Rose's problems. He said, "Marry me." So they were married very early the next day by the sheriff. And I gather Sir Gerald arrived on the pavement just after the ceremony had been performed, and there was quite a fight there. Alistair Crowley took his bride home, and within 3 days he was madly in love with her. Sadly, the marriage didn't last all that long. Poor Rose was to die certified insane through alcoholic poisoning.
There was even a child from the marriage, a baby girl, but she too succumbed to Crowley's Midas touch in reverse.
Crowley took his wife on a round-the-world trip, finally left her to come home on her own from India, and the child died of typhoid on the way home. It was typical. So many people that Crowley knew ended tragically. For example, nearly all the women that Crowley got involved with, and there were a lot of them, became alcoholics. He just seemed to do this to people. He didn't mind the children, for example, watching people having sex because, you know, he thought this was very good for people. He was kind of post-Freudian in that sense. He insisted on his mistress having sex with a goat and all kinds of things. And, of course, he also, in one of his magical rituals, killed a cat and got one of his disciples, Raoul Loveday, to drink its blood. The chap got gastroenteritis and died as a consequence. And it was his wife who went back to London, denounced Crowley to the Sunday Express, which came out with this headline about the wickedest man in the world. That was actually in John Bull that the Sunday Express said the same thing. And, of course, Crowley, who'd just published his first novel, and who was looking, which was quite successful, a thing called A Diary of a Drug Fiend, and was looking forward to becoming a literary celebrity, or at least making his living from this, suddenly found to his horror that, you know, the newspapers were denouncing him as a filthy beast and the man they'd most like to hang. He felt this was downright unfair. He felt that he was a serious magician. All of this sex wasn't just for the fun of it. He was really trying to achieve magical powers. In fact, he was really trying to become a kind of a Nietzschean Superman. That's how he saw himself. But, of course, for the rest of his life was all downhill from then on. That was in the 1930s.
Little wonder his Invernessian neighbours were scared of him. A local butcher Crowley was said to have argued with accidentally slashed his wrist with a knife and died while cutting up meat. His housekeeper suddenly fled the house and disappeared. A spiritual medium who stayed there became a prostitute. Crowley's coachman, a confirmed teetotaler, suddenly fell into a severe bout of delirium tremens. A workman appeared to go berserk and attacked Crowley, trying to kill him. Later, during a mountaineering expedition to K2, the world's second highest mountain in the Himalayas, several of the team died, with Crowley being blamed for it. He had to escape from India after allegedly murdering two men who he said tried to rob him. And even after his death, there was tragedy at Boleskine House when a subsequent owner committed suicide there. But curiously, those who actually knew Crowley don't have a bad word to say against the man. In this interview recorded in 1955, one of his Café Royal cronies, Louis Marlowe, maintained Crowley was not the font of all evil that he liked to pretend he was and that others seemed delighted to portray him as.
People seem to forget that he had his tongue in his cheek, that he had a very acute sense of humour indeed. One can remember a great many extraordinarily witty and brilliant things that he said. Of course, some of them are not quite repeatable. But he was a character who ought not to be represented simply as a figure of evil and the tool of the devil and the black magician. I think he's a man who will be remembered, and remembered simply because of the potency of his own identity.
Another regular acquaintance was novelist Christopher Isherwood. Isherwood and his close friend Gerald Hamilton got to know Crowley in Berlin during the 30s, as Hamilton recalled in this archive interview.
Isherwood and I went to call on him when he was in Berlin and had an exhibition of his paintings all to himself, opened by some important German. I had never met him before, but he was very anxious for us both to call and see him. From that day onwards, a certain friendship sprung up, and I enjoyed his company as much as I hope he may have enjoyed mine. The terrible wickedness which is still attached to his name, the wickedest man in the world, as he liked to be called, made me roar with laughter, because in point of fact, as I got to know him very well, both in Berlin and in London afterwards, I found him to be really a bon bourgeois, who liked a good cigar, good wines, a good meal, and above everything else, a good game of chess. He's fortunate in his biographer, John Simons, who's written two lives of Crowley, and who has very distinctly portrayed his amazing character. Erudite, a little inclined to be drunken, and above all, kind-hearted. That was how I found Alistair Crowley.
Crowley certainly did have an acute sense of humour. He published a series of hilarious limericks, many about people with whom he'd fallen out, and mostly unbroadcastable. But since his death, a significant number of people have taken Crowley more seriously than he probably took himself. His resurrection during the hippie years of the 60s raised him to the status of a cult hero. The Rolling Stones were moved by his influence to record an entire album around the theme of black magic, Their Satanic Majesty's Request. And you'll find Crowley's picture among the faces on the Beatles' classic Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And particularly in the United States, Crowleyanity has an increasing following.
A lot of people do take Crowley seriously. I personally find that I don't like Crowley. I don't like anything that he did. I don't like the personality. But he obviously has a very strong effect on a lot of people. See, his philosophy, do what thou wilt, is very appealing, isn't it? I think that Crowley probably was a man totally without conscience. Maybe someone that we would call a psychopath today.
He certainly had his tongue in his cheek, and he didn't think he was wicked at all. I'd point out that he really did some pretty disgusting and nasty things. He was a sort of extremely unpleasant man in many ways. I've written biographies of several people, you know, including Shaw and Rasputin, but Crowley is the first person that I would not have liked to have met. His absolute loathing of authority, of course, was exactly what the hippies loved. He seemed to be, you know, a bit like Wilhelm Reich, a figure who preached freedom, let it all hang out, do what you like. And I think this was the reason that the Beatles put his picture on their Sgt. Pepper album, and his books really began to sell once again. Oh, he would have become a kind of hippie saint if he'd still been around in the 60s. He died, of course, in 1947.
He has left a legacy, and there is a lot of people involved with Crowley and what he has left behind. Indeed, I know one or two that are very, very steeped in Crowleyism. And you look for more power, you crawl more power, you work at more power, and then it can destroy you in the end, like I said earlier. Because even though the man died in 1947, the power that he has left behind is still there, and the demons are still going about, I believe, that if they can still latch on them. Because I know that things do happen when people become involved deeply in the Crowleyism. Things going wrong. Accidents happening. Things happening out of the blue which shouldn't be happening at all, like things in the house going wrong. Darkness round about. Shades of the unknown coming round about rooms and people and the noises on stairs, which I've heard people complain about.
But the man who now occupies Crowley's house hasn't been enchanted by the magic of the great beast. Malcolm Dent says Crowley's legacy is something he'd rather be without, and it's not only the spiritual visitations to Boleskine which he finds disturbing.
I wish he'd get out of my life. I think that because of Crowley, we are invaded constantly with visitors claiming knowledge or interest or whatever in the occult, who come here and want to feel the aura of the house or feel the aura of Crowley's spirits or whatever, and I don't approve of that. I don't like it. It interrupts my life. And on top of that, I think that some of these people are... They're really in a state of ignorance as to what the occult really means and what it can do. I do think some of the people certainly that visit are dangerous sorts of people. I've had curses put on me by people. I've had people conducting rituals against me because I've been rude and tried to get rid of them. And I have seen people who I've asked to go away then turn up in the burial ground, which is in our ground, just below the house here, conducting all sorts of strange rituals and stuff in there. The man's dead. I wish a lot of people would realize that.
Deep mouthed from their thrones, deep seated, the choirs of the eons declare the last of the demons defeated. For man is the lord of the air. Arise, O man, in thy strength. The kingdom is thine to inherit, till the high gods witness at length that man is the lord of his spirit.
The Beast of Beleskin was produced and presented by Craig Anderson.